Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The question of reparations for the descendants of slaves comes up on occasion, but not with the seriousness of what happened recently on Capitol Hill. Last week marked the first time that Congress has considered the question in the form of a bill, H.R. 40. The U.S. House of Representatives held a hearing that attracted such a large crowd that three overflow rooms had to be opened to accommodate the throng. That bill would create a commission to develop proposals on how to address the lingering effects of America's original sin, slavery, and consider something the nation has never done, apologize for the harm that evil institution caused. But reparations are very controversial. Those opposed feel they would be wrong because no one alive today played a role in that time in our history. Even those who favor reparations are unsure exactly how they should be handled or who would be included or how much would be enough. Not since Reconstruction has talk of reparations reached this level, and with that first-of-its-kind congressional hearing and with various Democratic presidential candidates talking about the idea on the stump, now seems like a good time to join that conversation. So we invited one of the nation's leading thinkers on the topic to join us this hour. Dr. William Darity is the Samuel Du Bois Cook Professor of Public Policy at the Duke University Sanford School of Public Policy and the co-author of the forthcoming book From Here to Equality, Black Reparations in the 21st Century. He joins us from the studios of WUNC in Durham. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
The hearing I referred to was that of the House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties, and it was set to coincide with the observance of Juneteenth, which commemorates the emancipation of enslaved African Americans back in the 1860s. But Juneteenth comes every year, so why this discussion now, this year?
I'm not altogether certain, and I'm actually quite startled that it is taking place. I've been working on the subject of reparations for Black American descendants of persons enslaved in the United States, I think for approximately 30 years, and I anticipated continuing to work on it, regardless of what happened on the national stage, but I think it's really a propitious moment that we now are having this conversation in the chambers of Congress.
And you said that you are now more optimistic than you have ever been in your life about the enactment of reparations program that is comprehensive and transformative. Is that because the House committee took it up, subcommittee took it up, or were you that optimistic prior to their taking it up?
No, I became optimistic as a consequence of the hearings actually being held, since the legislation that was the subject of the hearings has been in existence since 1989 and has never been brought forward to this stage. And so observing the hearings actually occur strikes me as a really, really positive moment in terms of the possibilities of having an actual comprehensive reparations program.
Were you in Washington for those hearings?
I was not. I was invited to testify, but I was actually at a Juneteenth event that was being held in Birmingham, Alabama, called the Angela Project, which is an event that was commemorative of the first landing of enslaved Africans in the United States in Jamestown in 1619, so 400 years ago. So although I wasn't there, I submitted written testimony.
So I believe you just said that this legislation has been hanging around the halls of Congress since 1989. Is that the right year?
I believe so.
Okay, so who is behind pushing it forward now?
So originally, the Congress congressional representative who was responsible for introducing the bill was former Representative John Conyers. Currently, the bill is being managed by Representative Sheila Jackson Lee from Texas.
The hope by some for reparations has been in place for a very long time. You've been working on this for 30 years, you said, and it's certainly the hope for reparations predates that by probably about 100 years or more. It was promised at the very end of slavery when former slaves were promised 40 acres and a mule. That didn't happen. Do you worry that your hopes are about to be dashed yet again?
Well, insofar as restitution has not been made in 150 years, I feel quite patient about this. and I think that this moment provides us with an opportunity to launch in the direction. But if it peters out, I will not be devastated. I will be disappointed, but I will not be devastated, and I will continue to work on this as long as I can.
Certainly reparations would have been highly appropriate in 1865, following the Emancipation Proclamation and following the end of the Civil War. Are they less appropriate today?
No, not at all, because... If reparations had been provided in the form of the land grants of 40 acres, we would have completely altered the trajectory of racial wealth inequality in the United States. Hmm. We probably wouldn't need to have this discussion now. I think that one of the critical things that we have to address through a reparations program is what we now refer to as the racial wealth gap. And the racial wealth gap is actually starkly displayed by the difference in net worth between black and white households at the mean. So the average black household has $800,000 less in net worth than the average white household in the United States. And I think that the process of creating that kind of gap through intergenerational transfers of resources begins with the failure to provide formerly enslaved with the 40 acres that they were promised. It extends through the destruction of black property and black lives throughout the latter half of the 19th century into the first part of the 20th century, where there was a wave of white massacres that essentially eliminated or appropriated property and businesses that had been developed by black Americans. One of the most notable instances of this occurred right here in North Carolina in Wilmington in 1898. Mm-hmm. Another very famous instance is the 1921 massacre that took place in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in a community that was referred to as a Black Wall Street. So that's the second dimension, is the destruction of what wealth was accumulated by black Americans in the aftermath of the Civil War. And then a third phase of this process of reproducing and extending the racial wealth gap is associated with a set of policies that were adopted in the mid-20th century that were designed to create upward mobility and create an American middle class that was more extensive than it had ever been before. Those policies included the GI Bill, the provision of federal subsidies for home loan mortgages and the like, and the way in which those programs were administered were ways in which they vastly disproportionately benefited white Americans to the disadvantage of black Americans. And so as a consequence, we now have this massive wealth gap. But the starting point was the failure to provide the 40 acres.
Our guest today is Dr. William Darity from Duke University, where he's a professor of not only African-American studies, but he's a professor of economics. So economics plays a key role in what we're talking about here today. President Obama was opposed to reparations. He said the idea was impractical. Presidents have been wrong in the past on a variety of issues. I know you think the president is wrong. Why was he wrong?
I think that we actually can structure and design a very effective reparations program if we do it with care and attentiveness. I see no reason why it would be logistically impossible to do. And I've invested a substantial amount of my own research effort in trying to think about how we could best craft a reparations program.
So President Obama was a smart guy. He was a well-read individual. He certainly is an African-American, so he has a stake in the game here, so to speak. Surely he's aware of you.
Oh, I doubt that.
But. Well, was that politics? Was he simply being politically pragmatic by saying that reparations were impractical, or is he just grossly misinformed?
I have no idea what's in his soul, so I'm not sure if this was a strategic move or whether this was a sincere belief that mm-hmm. this is something that can't be done. But in either case, I think that it is something that can be done and can be done quite effectively. And I'd be glad to explore some of the logistical questions that people might have as we proceed with our conversation.
This bill before the House that was the subject of this discussion, as you mentioned, was sponsored by a Texas Democrat, Sheila Jackson Lee. That bill would authorize $12 million. For a 13-member commission to study the effects of slavery and make recommendations to Congress. It has very little chance of passing through the Senate. But I'm curious if you think we need a commission to study the impact of slavery. Don't we pretty much know what that impact was and continues to be?
Well, I'm fairly committed to procedure and the importance of procedure and the importance of generating an official national report that would be relevant to the development of legislation for a reparations program. As a precedent, I would turn to the provision of reparations for Japanese Americans for their unjust incarceration during World War II. Prior to the inauguration of that legislation, there was a congressional commission that had been appointed. It was called the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians. That commission had two tasks. The first was to set the historical record straight. And one of the key things that was accomplished by that commission was a clear demonstration that American officialdom knew quite well that Japanese Americans were not a threat to the security of the nation, but still proceeded to put them into camps. And then the second task that that commission had to fulfill was to design a program of restitution. And so I think in similar fashion, if we are going to be serious about establishing a reparations program for Native Black Americans, we will need a comparable commission to set the historical record straight about the trajectory of racial injustice in the United States and also to design a program of restitution.
Do you think that obviously this a commission like that with doing a research study like that and then publishing that study would bring a lot of people up to speed? Is it your opinion that most Americans don't know really what these real effects of slavery have been, or that they simply need to be reminded, or a light bulb needs to go off over their heads for them to understand and buy into the idea of reparations?
I would say all of those are factors that come into play that would make an official report by an expert commission very, very useful in terms of moving forward on the reparations program.
Dr. William Darity is our guest. He's professor at Duke University Sanford School of Public Policy. He's the co-author of the forthcoming book, From Here to Equality, Black Reparations in the 21st Century. We're going to talk about the pros and cons of this and the battle that has been going on for 150 or more years about this, and what will probably continue to go on as we go forward, because, as I said, it has little chance of passing through the Senate, largely because of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. And we'll hear what he had to say about this when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Dr. William Darity, professor at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy, professor of economics, professor of African American Studies, and the co-author of From Here to Equality, Black Reparations in the 21st Century. We're talking about it because it's back on the table. It was the subject, reparations for descendants of slaves. We're brought up in a House subcommittee meeting last week. It's also been a topic of conversation among some Democratic candidates for president. And one of the reasons this bill has little chance of passage is because it has little chance of getting through the Republican-controlled Senate right now. The Majority Leader Mitch McConnell from Kentucky, who has come out on the record in opposition to reparations, has said, "Reparations for something that happened 150 years ago, for whom none of us currently living are responsible, are not a good idea."
We've, tried to deal with our original sin of slavery by fighting a civil war, by passing landmark civil rights legislation. We've elected an African-American president. I think we're always a work in progress in this country, but no one currently alive was responsible for that.
A lot of people who are opposed to reparations, Doctor, would agree with everything Mitch McConnell just said. But let's unpack it. First of all, one of the things he said is that we elected an African-American president in our attempt to deal with our original sin of slavery. Really? I mean, is that how Barack Obama's election was viewed by some in this country, as a form of penance for slavery?
I'm not certain. I suspect that might be the case. My impression was that many people thought that his election was an indication that we had closed the door on problems of racial injustice.
Yes, we were living in a post-racial society as of that moment.
And patently that wasn't correct. A host of issues associated with racial injustice were very much in place during the course of his presidency. And we're not necessarily reversed by the policies that he proposed or supported. And in the aftermath of his presidency, there's such blatant evidence of overt racism in the United States. One of the most obvious cases is the chain of events that took place in Charlottesville, Virginia. We have the murder of parishioners at the Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina. So there's actually a large and ongoing wave of racist violence that's taking place in the United States right now. So we clearly are not post-racial. So if people thought that was a consequence of the Obama election, it was a mistaken belief. And I certainly don't see Obama's election in any way as constituting a program of reparations or restitution for America's history of racial injustice.
Passing this bill and paying reparations would do nothing to change racist attitudes among the people who hold them. Do you fear that if this were to pass at some time in the future, that if reparations were made at some time in the future, that this would actually inflame racist attitudes and perhaps violence?
So quite the contrary, because I'm determined that the route for establishing a reparations program must be through congressional legislation. And that would require a significant portion of the American population to be squarely behind adopting a reparations program. So it, in a sense, we would have to address our racial attitudes to make a reparations program a reality. Now, my assumption is that there's going to be some core group of Americans who are going to be unalterably hostile towards reparations. And then there's going to be a growing segment of the population that's receptive to the idea. But then there's going to be a third group that's on the fence. And that's the group in which the political work must be done to establish that this is the right thing to do, And this is a feasible thing to do.
If you'd like to join our conversation, I want to remind folks that they can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at charlottetalks. So the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, also mentioned that we have passed landmark civil rights legislation to atone for slavery. Again, I thought we passed that legislation to right the wrongs being inflicted on blacks through Jim Crow era laws and policies, not slavery. But he is right that it was a step in the right direction and one that many didn't see a need for at the time. There were a lot of people on the wrong side of history. Would reparations fall?
But I will say that at the point in which the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was adopted, I think it's pretty clear that a majority of Americans mm-hmm. were in favor of it.
Would reparations fall into that same category? If we enact reparations in some way, in some form, and we'll talk about how you think that what form that ought to take, would a lot of naysayers come to be on the right side of history with time?
This is quite possible. And I think that's another reason why, as we talked about it a little bit earlier, it's important to have a credible expert commission generate a report that talks about in depth America's racial history. And so I think that the existence of that report, something that people would read and review and study, would be very helpful in moving them in the direction of recognizing that this is an appropriate thing to do.
The man largely credited with reviving talk of reparation is a guy by the name of Ta-Nehisi Coates. He wrote a piece in 2014 in The Atlantic. He was the star witness at last week's hearing, and he responded to Mitch McConnell's suggestion that reparations aren't fair or necessary today because no one alive today was alive during the time of slavery.
We grant that Mr. McConnell was not alive for Appomattox, but he was alive for the electrocution of George Stinney. He was alive for the blinding of Isaac Woodward. He was alive to witness kleptocracy in his native Alabama and a regime premised on electoral theft. Majority Leader McConnell cited civil rights legislation yesterday, as well he should, because he was alive to witness the harassment, jailing, and betrayal of those responsible for that legislation by a government sworn to protect them. He was alive for the redlining of Chicago and the looting of black homeowners of some $4 billion. Victims of that plunder are very much alive today. I am sure they'd love a word with the majority leader.
So he makes the point that the end of slavery did not end oppression. Quite to the contrary, it did not end mistreatment either. And it was the beginning of policies put in place by governments at all levels that limited the ability of African Americans, as you've already mentioned, to build wealth and participate on a level playing field. Is that the argument that proponents of this should be focusing on? Not reparations for slavery, because no one was alive today who had anything to do with that in any way. Should it be more focused on redressing modern-day grievances that continue to this day?
Well, as I've emphasized, in my view, what should be addressed is the racial wealth gap, which is something that is a modern condition. But I do think that there's an important point here that you're extracting from Ta-Nehisi Coates' comments, which is it is a misnomer to refer to reparations as slavery reparations. Slavery was the crucible in which the kinds of injustices that have extended to the present moment originated. But I've consistently argued that a case for reparations must be predicated on three phases of American history. The first is the period of enslavement itself. The second, though, is the Jim Crow period, which lasted for almost a century, a period of legal segregation in the United States. And there's a number of us who are living victims of that period in time. We're getting old. And so if the nation waits long enough, the denial until death effect would occur, and folks could say there are no more living victims of Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. But that's a wholly immoral strategy. And then the third phase is the post-Civil Rights Act era, in which we do have ongoing and sustained racism that's manifest in police executions of unarmed blacks, that's manifest in the mass incarceration program that exists in the United States. And then from my perspective as an economist, it's manifest, as I've said time and again, in the immense, staggering racial wealth gap.
You said a little while ago that we wouldn't be in the situation we're in today, or African Americans would not be in that situation, had the government delivered on their promise of 40 acres and a mule to be given to every freed, enslaved person. I'm just curious if you think that had that happened, would that have stopped the onslaught or the onset of Jim Crow, or would we have seen an even greater backlash to this?
So for that program to have been effective, this program of land reform or land grants, it would have been essential for the federal government to maintain a Union military presence throughout the portions of the South in which those land grant allocations were made, and or provide arms to the formerly enslaved so that they could protect themselves. There is no question that there would have been an issue about preservation that was associated with the kinds of violence that would be inflicted by the ex-Confederates. Well, they really weren't ex-Confederates. they still were quite sympathetic to the Confederate cause. But yeah, that would have been a serious issue, and it would have required a defense response to succeed. But there's another dimension of this, which is the Reconstruction era policies also sought to incorporate blacks into the electoral and political process fully, and so it would have also been possible to prevent Jim Crow legislation from being adopted simply because blacks would have had a significant amount of political leverage as well.
And for a while, they did. They were elected officials, and then there was the backlash that removed them from office through various different means. So
that's right. And the consolidating moment was the decision to remove the Union troops from the South.
So the original compensation package was to have been 40 acres and a mule, which the government did not follow through on. That takes us to the question of what form reparations might take today and how much it would cost. And you've done a lot of research, extensive research on this. You say an effective reparations program would cost about, are you sitting down, everybody? $14 trillion. Put that into perspective. What else do we spend a sum like $14 trillion on? Do you know?
No, I'm not exactly sure what else we do spend it on.
Is something
I do know that the nation's annual level of wealth, total level of wealth, is approximately $100 trillion.
Okay,
and at the moment, black Americans have somewhere in the vicinity of $3 million to $4 million. $3 trillion to $4 trillion in wealth. So it's about 3 to 4% of the national total. If black Americans were to have a level of wealth that was consistent with their representation in the national population, then we're talking about $13 to $14 trillion.
So it's about 14% of our national wealth.
Yes.
Is something that expensive, although when you say 14%, I don't know that that's a lot, but to many people's minds, it is. So is something that expensive possible?
Yes, absolutely. And there's a variety of ways in which it can be done. I can't reveal the full range of ideas on this because I will make my publisher extremely unhappy.
When is the book coming out?
The book should be out in February 2020, and the final chapter is an attempt to detail how one might actually execute a reparations program. And there's some dimensions of that chapter that include materials that I have not talked about before. So it would be fresh from the work that my co-author and I have done. Well, but I will say this. One of the things that we attempt to demonstrate in that chapter is that you actually could finance a reparations program of that magnitude or scale without raising tax rates.
Democratic presidential candidate and California Senator Kamala Harris has her own proposal. It's called the LIFT Act. It provides a universal tax credit for families earning under $100,000. And she says that would lift 60% of black families out of poverty. Is the LIFT Act a reparations bill or one that would impact every citizen who falls under those parameters?
Well, the LIFT Act is actually a desirable policy. I've actually endorsed it myself, but it's hardly a reparations program. It would only put a mild scratch in the enormous racial wealth gap that we're talking about.
Is that the intent of the act?
No, and okay. I was going to say, because in part, the act is focused on income rather than wealth, where wealth is the difference between the value of what we own and what we owe, or the difference between the value of our assets or our debts. Or another way of thinking about it is wealth is our net property value. And that's very different from income, which is a flow of resources that's primarily governed by our earnings. And the LIFT Act is predicated on earnings. In fact, if you have no earnings, you will not receive any type of benefit from the LIFT Act itself. So the LIFT Act is focused on income. It's not focused on wealth. So it's not going to do anything along those lines. And I hope Senator Harris has not made the claim that it would do anything to reduce the racial wealth gap.
This is kind of off the topic, but she's a Democratic senator in a Republican-controlled body. Is there any chance that her LIFT Act proposal will gain any traction until the Democrats take the Senate, too, if they take the Senate?
So you raised this question about H.R. 40 also, and so my answer, you know, my realpolitik answer is the Senate would have to be changed in 2020 also for any number of these kinds of policies to become effective.
The goal for most advocates of reparations is to move the share of the nation's wealth. Black Americans hold, I think you've talked about this, less than 3% of that wealth, despite constituting 12 to 13% of the population, and advocates would like to increase that share to 12 or 13%. When we come back from the break, I'd like to talk about something you've pointed out, that without reparations, it will take 228 years for black Americans to reach parity with white people. I want to talk about that when we come back with Dr. William Darity, professor at Duke University Sanford School of Public Policy. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Sandy Darity, let's put it that way, a professor at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. He's a professor of African American Studies. He's an economist. He's done extensive research on the topic of possible reparations for the descendants of slaves. And his forthcoming book details a lot of his prescriptives. It's called From Here to Equality, Black Reparations in the 21st Century, some of which he won't talk about, but there are some things in the book that we will talk about in a moment. But I mentioned just before the break that despite constituting 12 to 13% of the population, African Americans only hold about 3% of the nation's wealth, and it would take 228 years, by your calculations, to reach parity with white people.
Well no, actually, it's not my calculation. And it's not parity. What that study actually says is it would take 228 years, given the current trajectory, for black Americans to reach the level of wealth that white Americans currently have.
And with reparations, would they be at parity?
Well, it depends upon how the reparations program was designed and executed. If we made a sufficient transfer of resources to build black American assets to a level that's comparable to that held by whites, yeah, we could be at parity. And I think that should be an objective of a reparations program.
At the risk of sounding horribly patronizing, no one taught me about money as a kid, and I took one economics class in college, so you would not have liked me. I didn't do well
<It's okay. laughs>
in that class. But if you give people reparations, if you give any, I don't care what color your skin is or what your background is, if you don't know about money and how to use it, and suddenly you have a windfall, this happens to a lot of lottery winners. How long can you sustain the money you've been given in the form of reparations without squandering it because you've never had money in your life?
So I have several responses to that.
Okay.
The first is, I think that there is a mythology about what happens to lottery winners. We actually have a study that we're undertaking at my research center, the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity, where we're looking at what happens to people who receive windfalls. And we're actually finding that that it's not the case that people squander the funds. Hmm. And in fact, most lottery winners leave resources for the next generation. Now, that leaves open the question as to whether or not the next generation squanders the funds. But the recipients of the windfall themselves actually make what looks to most of us like very sensible decisions about their funds. The second thing is, if we really are going to be concerned about how people make use of the funds, we certainly could have, as a prelude to a reparations program, some type of financial management or financial literacy training that we could provide to all eligible recipients of the funds. Some people refer to this as pre-reparations preparation. But then the third point I want to make is, it seems kind of odd to me that this question is only raised in the context of conversations about reparations for Black Americans. Now, I know you didn't do that because you said this is a problem that anybody could face, but I don't recall anybody asking how Japanese Americans would use the funds that they received under that reparations program, nor do I recall anybody asking how victims of the Holocaust would use the funds that they received from the German government as restitution.
Good point. The goal, some advocates don't necessarily envision the government writing a check to every Black man, woman, and child in America. What form do you see the, I know you don't want to talk about some of the details of your book, but what form do you see these reparations taking?
Well, I can definitely talk about what I have talked about in the past. Which is to say, I think for symbolic and substantive reasons, some significant portion of a reparations fund should be devoted to direct payments to eligible recipients. Those direct payments don't necessarily have to be cash transfers per se. There could be less liquid assets that people are provided with, which would not translate into immediate spending, and might be committed to actually building their wealth over time. So I've actually talked in some of the work that I've done about there being a fund that could be viewed as a portfolio of reparations, that there could be multiple uses that are given to the fund, including some sorts of community-based or institution-building resources. But again, I think for both symbolic and substantive reasons, some significant portion of the fund must be a direct payment.
Some advocates suggest zero interest loans for prospective Black homeowners, free college tuition, community development plans to spur the growth of Black-owned businesses in African-American neighborhoods. Are those good solutions in your mind?
So I view those as solutions that are useful for all Americans, and that those are programs that should be enacted for all Americans. But I don't view them separately or taken collectively as making any type of significant headway in closing the racial wealth gap, which again is, you know, what I think is the central or primary goal of a reparations.
You mentioned a portfolio of reparations, and I believe I read that you say that among the items in that portfolio should be subsidized health care. How do you envision that being structured?
No, actually, I think subsidized health care is something that should be universal, and it should take the form of the equivalent of what people are talking about now as Medicare for All. That is not reparations. That's not a program that would be specific to addressing racial injustice.
Then correct me if I'm wrong about this. In addition to the individual payments that you're saying we should start with individual payments to those who are eligible, you also suggest trust funds. How would that work?
Yeah, so that would be a situation in which we are creating a less liquid asset as a resource that's being built into the distribution of the reparations resources. And essentially what that would mean is individuals would have to effectively get the approval of a trustee for the use of the funds that they have in mind. So, for example, somebody might want to use the resources from their reparations fund for the purposes of starting a new business. And so they would have to bring forward a credible business plan and get approval of the trustee to move forward with using the funds on that basis. So that would be a trust account.
Would everybody get the same amount of money in their trust account?
I think that there would have to be some base amount that's the same for everyone. But I think that there needs to be some adjustment because there's such a high degree of wealth inequality within the Black community. So Blacks collectively have very little wealth, but what Blacks have is distributed quite unequally. And so I think there should be some core basic amount that goes to everyone who is eligible for reparations, but then there should be some flexibility in terms of other amounts that are adjusted to folks who have greater economic need.
Who should be eligible?
So I've advanced two criteria for eligibility. The first is an individual must demonstrate that they are a descendant of at least one person who was enslaved in the United States, or another way of putting it is they would have to have at least one ancestor who was enslaved in the United States. And then the second criterion would be that the individual would have to demonstrate that for at least 10 years before the onset of a reparations program or the onset of a commission to study reparations, whichever comes first, they would have had to have self-identified as Black, Negro, African American, or the equivalent.
So let's go back to proving your statement that in order to be eligible, you'd have to be able to trace your lineage back to at least one ancestor who was enslaved. Is that easy or difficult to do?
I wouldn't say it was easy, but I wouldn't say it was difficult either.
Is it expensive to do?
It could be, but we could definitely build in to a reparations program resources for the genealogical work that would need to be done to establish one's eligibility.
And since slavery was such a long time ago, and since so many people alive today were impacted by Jim Crow, were impacted by redlining, were impacted by all kinds of laws and policies that left them behind, wouldn't a better way to do this be to prove that you or a family member, a direct ancestor of yours, your grandfather, your great-grandfather, your great-grandmother, were impacted by Jim Crow as opposed to slavery?
Well, the initial claim that's to be directed to the United States government is anchored on the failure to provide the formerly enslaved with the 40 acres and a mule.
Okay.
And so I think that an ancestral connection has to be made to those folks who were emancipated at the end of the Civil War, who never received restitution.
You also said that reparations should also address the ongoing racism manifest in police executions of unarmed Blacks, mass incarceration, and employment discrimination. Are you calling for reparations for the families of those who lost their lives in altercations with the police, or for money to rehabilitate police departments that have engaged in this behavior? How would that work?
No, actually, what I'm calling for is those conditions are part of the bill of particulars of the reasons why a reparations program must be enacted. I am not saying that we should necessarily, although this is a possibility, partition out individual or piecemeal injustices and try to set them up on a scorecard. And this is why I'm very focused on saying that the racial wealth gap gives us a very strong index of the full effects of racial injustice in the United States, and that's what should be the focal point. But I am saying that one of the reasons we should do this is because of ongoing racism in the United States.
We have a very short memory in America, and one of the ongoing conversations we're having right now is about what to do with these Confederate memorials and statues. And much of the reason given by those who want to keep them has nothing to do, really, with why they were erected in the first place, and people don't remember why they were erected in the first place. You argue that a key dimension of any reparations would be to ensure that young people receive an accurate and comprehensive curriculum on slavery, the Civil War, Reconstruction, and the post-slavery world in America to combat what you call the false narrative created by the United Daughters of the Confederacy. Talk about that.
Well, I think you described my objectives quite accurately. I would like to say this. My partner and co-author Kirsten Mullen and I recently were in Birmingham, Alabama, and we actually visited the first Confederate White House, which happens to be located at the present moment across the street from the Alabama State House. And one of the things that was most striking to us was the fact that throughout this this home, which was the residence of Jefferson Davis, there is no mention of the term slavery or any reference to the notion that there were slave states, nor any reference to the notion that the Civil War was prompted by the desire on the part of the slaveholding states to preserve slavery. Another interesting dimension of that location is the fact that Jefferson Davis is referred to as an American patriot throughout the location, when in fact Jefferson Davis is the leader of a movement that would have led to the dissolution of the United States.
Yeah.
And so that reinforced our view that there is an important task that must be associated with telling the truth about American history, and the truth in particular about the Civil War and the Reconstruction period.
We have about a minute left here, but not all African Americans are calling for reparations or even want them. One of the people who testified before the House last week, writer Coleman Hughes, said that a federal payment would be the equivalent of the government calling him a victim, bestowing the label without his consent. And he went on to say, you might call that justice. I call it justice for the dead at the price of justice for the living. What's your take on that?
So my first take is, if this gentleman does not want to receive reparations payments, then once the program is in place, he certainly has the option of not accepting any kind of benefit or compensation that he might be eligible for. So nobody's going to force you to take the money.
Okay. Dr. William Darity, professor at Duke University Sanford School of Public Policy, and the co-author of the forthcoming book, which details everything we couldn't talk about with regard to how reparations might actually be handed out. His book is called From Here to Equality, Black Reparations in the 21st Century, and it will be out in February. Thank you for joining us for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.